So believe it or not, this morning we're almost through chapter 16 of the book of Acts. Paul and Silas have come to Philippi. This is Paul's second missionary journey. They're with Timothy and Luke. And so far in these past few days in Philippi, we've seen Lydia and her household come to faith and be baptized. We've seen the young girl who was enslaved with a spirit cleansed. And then having lost that evil spirit, she's now unable to give fortunes and see the future. And so her owners have lost their income. And so they drag Paul before the magistrates. And as they bring them before the magistrates, they make accusations against them and they stir up the crowd against them. The magistrates. Last week we didn't talk much about the magistrates. And so before we go forward, I wanted this morning to explain to you what a magistrate of the city of Philippi would have been at that time. Who were they? Have you ever heard of the Pax Romana, the Roman peace? As Rome conquered the entire region, there was a peace that kind of settled, a very long peace. And one of the ways that Rome was able to keep the peace was that they allowed each of these areas, each of these countries, to maintain their own customs. They allowed them to maintain their own worship in most cases. And what they would do is they would allow local city leaders to be put in place to kind of govern the local things that were going on. And so this kept the people from uprising. It kept rebellion down, and it was a way for them to slowly bring Roman values and Roman principles out through the colonies and across the entire empire. And so sometimes they would allow the current leaders to stay. Sometimes they would place one of the Roman military in place there to help guide. But these magistrates, one of the things I wrote a note here, don't mistake that Rome had several horrible leaders, and there was great persecutions against the church. But at this time in Acts, it hasn't really kicked into full gear yet. And so you're still kind of under the Roman peace and these Roman laws. Each city would have this magistrate, and they had three goals that was placed on these magistrates. One, keep the peace. Two, follow Rome's rule of law. And so as long as your local ordinances didn't interfere with Roman law, you could pretty much do all of your kind of civil leadership there. But you had to follow Rome's law, Rome's values. Third, most importantly, make sure all the taxes were paid on time. That was, for them, what they were really watching over. And as long as those were done well, it was good to be a magistrate. It was kind of a cushy job. You definitely had income. You had standing in the community. And so alongside the magistrates were these other group of folks that were called lictors or sergeants, or your Bible calls them policemen in this particular section. And what the actual term in the Greek means is they were those who were authorized to carry the rod. And they did carry a rod. And so what they were is kind of the enforcement, the muscle behind the mouth of these magistrates. And so you would rarely see a magistrate without their muscle attached very closely with them. And so it was those that beat Paul and Silas with rods the day before. And so ultimately, let's see here, my notes. Most of the magistrates, if you want a way of thinking about them, is that they dealt with local civil issues. Most of the criminal issues would be put up to a procurator or to a governor. It would be sent up chain. They dealt with a lot of civil issues that were going on, municipal issues in the cities that they were in. And so they would pass anything that was going to require punishment, especially corporal punishment, they would pass it up. And so one of the writers says that a magistrate was part city councilman, part civil judge, part DA. And that's kind of when you put those three parts together, that was what a magistrate was. They were always afraid that they were going to overstep their bounds And if they overstepped their bounds, Rome would come in and they would place their own leaders in charge of a city. They would turn it into a Roman colony. They would then bring in all of their Roman troops, and then all of the people would lose that freedom to kind of govern themselves. And so they towed the line. You'll understand why that is important as we go forward in the message today. But these magistrates, as we saw in last week's lesson, they tore off the garments of Paul and Barnabas and they ordered them to be beaten with rods. And then they were thrown into prison and they were held in the innermost cell, and their feet, bruised and bloodied, were placed into stocks. And at midnight, they were praying and singing hymns unto God with the other prisoners listening to them. And in the midst of their prayers and their singing, an earthquake happened, a great earthquake that shook this prison in such a way that all of the cell doors were open and all of the shackles fell off all of the prisoners. And as the jailer pulled out his sword to kill himself, seeing the doors being open, it was Paul who called out to him saying, "We're all here. Don't harm yourself." We saw last week how the jailer came to believe, pulled Paul out of prison, took him outside, brought him to his home. Paul and Silas were able to preach the gospel to his family. His family believed, and he and his household were all baptized. He dressed their wounds. They rejoiced. And it appears that then they put Paul and Silas back into prison. And here we are on the morning after, at verse 35 of Acts 16. "But when it was day, the magistrate sent the police, saying, 'Let those men go.' And the jailer reported these words to Paul, saying, 'The magistrates have sent to let you go. Therefore, come out now and go in peace.' But Paul said to them, 'They've beaten us publicly, uncondemned, men who are Roman citizens, and have thrown us into prison. And do they now throw us out secretly? No. Let them come themselves and take us out.' The police reported these words to the magistrates, and they were afraid when they heard that they were Roman citizens. So they came and apologized to them. And they took them out and they asked them to leave the city. And when they went out of the prison, they visited Lydia. And when they had seen the brothers, they encouraged them and then departed." So we come to the next morning. The magistrates have now sent their goon squad, you know, the guys with rods, to the jailer. And the jailer, who is probably really excited when he hears this news, right? They sent them there, and apparently the jailer had put him back in the cell. And as they come, you can imagine he was with great joy going into Paul and Silas. "You've been set free. You can go in peace. It's all over." The magistrates wanted them to leave the city quietly. They wanted them to secretly be put out. Just let them go. Luke doesn't tell us why the magistrates had a change of heart. And if you read the commentators and a lot of stuff, everyone's got an opinion as to why, what changed their mind. I don't know why. Reading all the way through, Luke doesn't tell us. I just know who changed their mind. God had changed their mind. They changed their mind. They were going to let them go. And as much as it was great news to the jailer, he adds, right? They just said, "Let him go." He adds, "And you can go in peace. You know, it's all over with. This is all done." You can see that the jailer, you can see his attitude by the way in which he sends them off, or the way in which he asks them to go. But when we come to verse 37, we get a response from Paul that's a bit unexpected. And it seems uncharacteristic. Not just of Paul, but of the New Testament. This is strange that he would stand firm on his rights and make these guys come in and apologize to him. In the Greek, when you bring this out, what Paul says to them, it's important for you to understand. First off, he says they've beaten us publicly. And that's emphasized. That's put front and center. They did this publicly. Equally emphasized right behind it is this word uncondemned. And the word, when you put them together, uncondemned, carries with it not tried in a court, not found to be guilty, and not sentenced by someone authorized to offer that sentence. So when he says uncondemned publicly, this is a pretty strong charge. And then he adds to the thing, especially to men who are Roman citizens. So, I want you to pick this up, that he calls out publicly uncondemned. If you go back, and this week I got, you know how I always go into the details, and so I went into Roman law, values, and customs of that particular time. And there were statutes on the books that Rome and its citizens were very, very proud of. You can go up and look, the Valerian statutes or the Parthian statutes, both of them say the same thing, both for the place of Rome, the country of Rome, and its colonies and its citizens, wherever they may be. Rome had strict laws and a value system. It's almost kind of Rome's equivalent to a Bill of Rights for their citizens. And paramount to it was due process. He could not be punished without a trial. A Roman citizen cannot be punished without a verdict. A Roman citizen cannot be punished because there were protections given to the citizens of Rome. There was a value system to the Roman Empire. You needed evidence. You needed witnesses. You needed a judge who was authorized. And then he needed to hear the evidence. He needed to make a judgment. He needed to put forth a sentence. And then and only then could you do punishment, capital punishment to a Roman citizen. Not only that, to do it publicly was another degree. To do a public punishment of a Roman citizen, the crime had to be absolutely, you know, a horrific crime, something that was very public, everything else. And so the standard of proof, the standard of evidence was even higher the more publicity something like that would get. And so what you find in here in this Roman Bill of Rights, if you will, equivalent, punishments only to be administered after a proper trial. It's a value system that Parthian writes that we hold dear. So Paul, in calling out these magistrates, he basically calls to their attention, not only was I punished, beaten, we were imprisoned, our feet put in stocks, without due process, uncondemned. There was no trial. There was no evidence. There was no witnesses. There was no sentencing. And you did it publicly. There would have been a higher call. And what we find, these magistrates probably weren't authorized. There were some magistrates through there that had special dispensation, but these probably weren't authorized even to take that action had they gone through all of those things. And so as he brings that to their attention, he says, and now you want to send us on our way secretly. Our reputations, our physical being have been damaged publicly in front of the entire city. And now you just want to have us go out secretly. What were they accused of? It's interesting to go back and remember what they were accused of, because they're false accusations, and what's going to be interesting is you're going to see those accusations turn. The accusations made publicly about them is that they were disturbing the city. They were disturbing the peace. They knew that would get the magistrate's attention, because one of the main goals of a magistrate is to keep the peace. Second, they advocated customs, values, that are not lawful for Romans to accept or practice. And you can see what Luke's doing. What Paul's doing is he's showing the hypocrisy of what they were doing. It wasn't us that disturbed the peace. It was the slave owners. And it wasn't us who were disturbing the values of Rome. It's you. Not only were the accusations false, they were completely turned around. And so when we come to the end of this section, he says, should we leave secretly? No. And I want you to understand, most of your Bibles will have an exclamation point. That's because in the Greek, this is an emphatic no. Paul tells the jailer, let them come themselves and bring us out. Wow, this seems uncharacteristic. You know, you come to that point, you just go, that just doesn't sound like Paul. Why? Because in 1 Corinthians, Paul writes of his right to be paid a salary. He talks about his right to be married, to have a wife. He talks about his right to work for a living. And it's not just a common sense right. It's a right that's guaranteed to him. It's his right as a Jew. It's right under the law. And then what does he tell the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 12? If others share this rightful claim, do not we even more? Nevertheless, we've not made use of this right. We endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Earlier in the same letter to the Corinthians, Paul tells the Corinthians, don't have lawsuits with one another. 1 Corinthians 6, 7, he asks and tells them, why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? It seems most times Paul doesn't insist on his own rights. But here he does. We know from the Gospels that Jesus did not defend against the authorities. Not a word did he speak. Teaching us to do what? To turn the other cheek. To give our cloak as well. To love our enemies. Quick to forgive, slow to anger. Paul teaches us in the New Testament, return blessing when reviled. To endure persecution. When others slander you, what are you to do in response? Speak kindly. Entreat them. Gentleness. When people hate, respond in love. We're to turn the other cheek, endure, suffer long, be defrauded, love our enemies, all what Paul says over and over again, for the sake of Christ. To not undermine the gospel, to not get in the way. In Acts 5:41, we have Peter, who does what? He gets beaten. He and John, and then they get put into jail. The next morning, do they say, excuse us? No, what does it say? It says they left the presence of the council rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer dishonor for the name. That sounds like the New Testament. That sounds more like what we're used to seeing. We find a place even where Jesus does call out injustice. It's one of very few places that he does. Turn with me to John chapter 18. As I take you to Jesus, he's to be our model in just about everything. The one problem we have, and Kevin DeYoung brings this out, I think, really well, is that he had a different purpose than we have. He came to take our sin upon himself. He came to atone for sin. He came to take our mocking. He came to take our shame. He came to take all of those things. When it comes to this particular, Kevin DeYoung says we're better off looking at Paul in this sense because his mission was a little different than ours. But read John chapter 18, verses 19 to 24. The high priest then questioned Jesus, this is at the end, about his disciples and his teaching. And Jesus answered him, I've spoken openly to the world. I've always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all Jews come together. I've said nothing in secret. Do you see that he's defending himself? He's standing up. What you're accusing me is not true. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I said. When he had said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, is that how you answer the high priest? And Jesus answered him, if what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. But if what I said is right, why do you strike me? Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. So Jesus here Even here, what does he do? He stands up for his rights, but then takes a slap for it. And what we see throughout Jesus' life is the injustice of it. And this whole life of Jesus, every time you see this, it's injustice after injustice after injustice, because there's an innocent man taking what we deserve. Grace. Some people say, I just want justice. Christians don't say that. We are very thankful that our God has grace and that in his justice he sent his son to die for us. Unmerited favor. We do not deserve it. Beloved, this is a tough question. When do we stand and insist on our rights? Much of the New Testament encourages us to turn the other cheek, love our enemies, endure suffering. But here, Paul insists on his rights. Why? There are times when we are to defend our rights. There are times that we do take a stand. And Paul does this here. He does it again in chapters 22 and 23. He does it there as he claims his rights as a Roman citizen, and he does it there as he claims his rights as a Jew before the Sanhedrin. But here, how do we know then when to defend and when to let it go? When to take a stand and when to turn the other cheek? When to be defrauded and when to call on our civil rights? In the cases where you find Paul standing on his right, where it occurs, it's always for the sake of the gospel. The love of the brothers who are weak, the love for those who are prone to stumble, it's never for his own sake. He never stands on his rights for himself. It's always for the sake of the gospel. It's always for the love of the brothers. Some of Paul's main points in his writing to the Corinthians, you can see, because he tells them why to set it aside. Why do you set aside your rights? Why do you not exercise your liberty? He tells them, don't get in the way of the gospel, Acts 9:12. 9:19, although I'm free from all, I've made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them. Verse 23 of chapter 9, I do it all for the sake of the gospel. Chapter 8, verse 9, he says, make sure this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. Chapter 8, we see Paul's concern for the weaker brothers when he's unwilling to do anything that would cause one of them to stumble. And so you start to see why it was that he would give up his rights. Jesus gave up his rights for justice, his ability to stop the accusations. Think about Jesus. He was able to stop the accusations in a moment. Jesus had the rights of the universe. He had the rights as a sovereign. He had the rights as the commander of legions of angels. At any given moment throughout his entire life, he could have said, enough! He laid it aside. Why? For you. He went through every mocking. He went through every injustice in his life for you. Everything that you deserved, every accusation that is against you, every sin that you need paid, everything that he endured was for you. Therefore, when do we give up our rights? Why do we give up our rights? We do it for him. When do we stand on our rights? When it glorifies him. When it's for him. So here in Acts 16, Paul does not let this go quietly. He stands up and he says, no. And he tells them to come themselves and take us out, which is basically saying, you're going to come and you're going to publicly apologize and you're going to walk us out of this cell so that everybody in this city knows that we have been exonerated and set free. That's what he's telling them. Why does he exert his rights? Well, we understand the New Testament principle now. For the sake of the gospel, for the love of the brethren, especially the new and the weak, who's he doing this for? Beloved, he's doing it for Lydia and her household. He's doing it for that little girl who's been cleansed. He's doing it for this jailer and his family. He might be doing it for those prisoners that were listening. He's doing it for the Lord, and he's doing it for the gospel. We don't know precisely which of these. We just know Paul's motives and principles and what drove him. And so we know that this is what was driving him. And so you look at verse 38. When they get this message back, this is what they're requesting. They were afraid when it was reported to them that they were Roman citizens. They understood the charge. If Paul wanted to make this into a mess, it was going to be a big mess. And they were, at a minimum, going to lose their positions. More than that, they could lose the whole town's privileges. This was a big deal. And so these magistrates had real fear. And in verse 39, you see something that you don't often see in the New Testament. You don't find it very often happening throughout the scriptures. These magistrates came to the prison and apologized to Paul and Silas. This is a rare instance here. This is huge. Even though they did it inside the cell, we already know the prisoners are listening. This is going to get out that the magistrates apologized. They were then brought out by the magistrates. Do you know how humiliating and how humbling this was for the magistrates? And the magistrates escorted Paul and Silas out of the prison, and then they asked them to leave the city. And the Greek here is really fun, because the Greek here tells you how they asked them to leave the city. And it basically, the words that's used there is they begged, urged, and pleaded with them politely to leave the city. And so he's trying to say, it's not just, now it's time for you to go. No, they're like, dear sirs, we've already apologized. If you wouldn't mind leaving. And look at verse 40. They don't leave right off. They went out to the prison, out of the prison, and they went to visit Lydia. They went to Lydia's house. First place they went, we're free, we're out. The Lord bless you and keep you. We're going to go on with our second missionary journey, but we wanted to stop by to let you know that we're safe. We're good. God's on the throne. And they wouldn't leave until they'd met with all the brethren, all the new believers, all these folks, the jailer and his family, all the folks that had come to faith while they were there. They all met there at Lydia's house. They didn't leave until they'd encouraged them all. God is still on his throne. So why did Paul do this? Because if they hadn't exerted their right and secretly left Philippi, what would have been the perception back in Philippi? If you're a Christian, you're going to get beat up and thrown out. And the same is going to go for anyone that comes to faith here, is we're going to get rid of you, and we're going to get rid of you, and we're going to get rid of you. The crowds would have no fear of dragging Christians to the magistrates, because they knew the magistrates then would have them beaten, imprisoned, and thrown out. But now the crowds know that the magistrates aren't going to be listening to the crowd, the mob, quite as freely as they did before. They'll be a little bit slower to come. And trust me, the persecution's going to come. By the time Paul writes the letter, persecution's going to be coming from Rome. But today, Paul bought the church some time to strengthen and to grow. It would be a while before it would come against this church. And what I stopped this week and saw is for these young believers, think about what they saw in these short few weeks. Think about what they witnessed. They saw God's hand, God's sovereignty so visibly. First, these servants came to their town and they brought the message of the truth, and our hearts awakened and the Spirit came and everything was different. Not only that, these servants who came, they were beaten and accused and stripped, thrown into prison, and beaten and bruised in prison. You know what they did? In the darkest of the night, they were praying and they were singing. And in the midst of their prayers and their songs, God shook the earth with an earthquake in such a way that every cell door was opened and every shackle was unfastened. And they didn't leave. They stayed. Do you know why? Because God had an appointment with a jailer and his family. And God had sent Paul and Silas right there, right at that time, so that they would be able to give the truth to this family. And he would do another miracle as he brought these folks to faith. And they were baptized. And they're with us now. And if that wasn't enough, God moved their hearts. They let them go free. And then they had to come and apologize. And these beloved men came before they left to tell us how much they loved us and to share with us their courage. Because that's what the Greek encouragement means, to share courage with another. They wouldn't leave until they had shared their courage with this Philippian church. Why did Paul exert his right? It was for the sake of the gospel. It was for the love of the brethren. Careful always, right, to not get in the way, to cause people to stumble. These new believers in the faith now have a taste of God's sovereignty, a taste of God's love. There's no doubt in my mind that what they were left with was a sense of, as Paul and Silas and Timothy and Luke went on to the next city, I can imagine that first church service, that first gathering of these new believers, as they talked about how awesome their God is, how far his love reaches, how amazing his grace, how powerful his gospel. There's no doubt that they came to an understanding of the words of Isaiah, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring the good news, as they thought of Paul and Silas. We'll start chapter 17 next week. When do we exert our rights and take a stand, beloved? We do it for the sake of the gospel. We do it for the love of our brothers. We never do it for our own pride, our own selfish reasons, our own reputations. It's always for the gospel. It's always for his glory. Careful always to not get ourselves in the way, not to cause someone to stumble. Paul writes, love covers a multitude of sins. You know why? Why do we live this way? That we might win some to Christ.